This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up today, fires burn through the night in tough conditions, and it comes as thousands gather around the world in protest.
The apocalyptic scenes that we've got at the moment are just the catalyst for me to get up and do something.
I'd like the firefighters to be funded more, I'd like more schemes to be set up, and just money, and to actually admit that climate change is real.
We'll also take you on board HMAS Adelaide as the disaster relief effort continues, and a major test of China's influence. Millions of voters head to the polls in Taiwan. First to the latest on the bushfires, and we'll head to New South Wales, where fires in the Snowy Mountains area have joined to become the state's second mega blaze. There are about 150 fires burning across the state this morning, and we saw more emergency warnings overnight, but conditions have now eased. Our reporter Isabel Rowe has been covering the state's fire crisis for AM this week. She's in Nowra on the south coast this morning.
Well, the good news, Tom, is that things have calmed down a little bit. We're waiting to hear this morning from the RFS about damage, if any, but it looks like it's been not nearly as bad as the firefighters had predicted. I've just heard this morning that there were wind gusts up to 113 kilometres an hour as that southerly change came through. That was what firefighters were really concerned about. But it looks like they've managed to keep a handle on those fires of concern. So the major fire of concern last night was that really large fire. That's three fires that are now joined in the Snowy Mountains area, over 640,000 hectares. They have been putting some of those ski fields at risk. This Threadbow and Perisher ski fields are okay, but as we know, the Selwyn one was destroyed earlier in the week. We did hear that there were four firefighters injured battling that blaze overnight. Two of them treated for heat stress and two of them treated for minor burns. But other than that, we don't think there was any major damage from that southerly change last night.
Right. And so what are the areas firefighters are watching today?
Well, they're still keeping an eye on this really large blaze in the Snowy Mountains. And they're also being concerned about the Kangaroo Valley area. There is going to be a possible storm this morning, of all things, in the Snowy Mountains area. So, of course, that could be a concern with lightning and those, the Kangaroo Valley, the Penrose area, the Wingello area that have already had fire. That is on the edge of a front. It's actually raining this morning in Nowra, but it's very smoky as well. And I suggest that that would be the conditions for lots of the region at the moment.
Now, I mean, Isabel, you've spent the week covering fires in the state's southeast, in the south coast and across the southern highlands. How are these communities faring?
Yeah, they're really struggling. I think it's hard to understand when you're not in it that it is all-consuming, this disaster, even if you don't have a fire on your doorstep, which many people don't. There are shops closed, the tourists are gone, the streets are filled with fire trucks and people in there working. People are constantly on edge. I've been through so many towns where there's been stories of loss. But there's, you know, stories of hope, but stories of loss. And I was in one town, Mogo, which I think particularly struck me. Mogo is on the New South Wales south coast. It's a really small town and it has a lot of history and most of the town has been flattened. And when I was there, I spoke to a woman called Christine Peters, whose house was spared just after flames got literally to the front door.
Surface damage, really. It is devastating, but it's not.
Could have been worse.
Yeah, that's right. It could have been worse. It's just when you look around and see all the plants and plants,
yeah, the garden,
your fruit trees.
The garden's gone.
Yeah, everything's scorched. And yeah, but well, as so lucky, we have a house and different people haven't.
You're from Mogo. You grew up here?
I grew up here, yeah.
What is it like to drive down the main street now and see what's happened?
Tearful. Mm. Horrible. I mean, the schools there that we went to school in, and yeah, the little old, everything's gone. It's just memories.
Christine Peters from Mogo on the New South Wales South Coast, and Isabel Rowe reporting there. Heading now to Victoria, where conditions have eased in bushfire-hit areas of the state's east. But now, authorities are once again faced with the challenge of supporting isolated communities. Hostile winds and high temperatures yesterday fanned bushfires in many areas, including places that are still cut off by road. Our reporter David Sparks is in Bairnsdale in East Gippsland. David, do we have any idea how much damage was done yesterday?
No, we don't know that yet, and that's going to be one of the big priorities for emergency services today. So trying to get around and assess the damage is going to be a huge task, because these fires were spread around a huge area yesterday. They flared up from around midday. We'd been waiting for it to happen all morning with very high temperatures, and then the wind just built up and up in the early afternoon, and we had major fires burning on the outskirts of towns like Omeo and Buchan and Orbost, and in the far east, Cann River, and then up in the alpine regions around Mount Hotham and Mount Buffalo, and then way up in the state's northeast as well. So it's a huge area that was covered by these fires yesterday. They're still burning, particularly in the alpine areas, so it's going to be a day today of getting on top of the fires that still exist, using the easing conditions to try and build containment lines and whatnot, and figure out how much damage was done.
We can certainly hear some of the wind there still. David, did many people evacuate their homes before these fires?
Look, a lot of people have evacuated already over the past couple of weeks. A lot of people evacuated before last Saturday and simply didn't bother to go back because they didn't feel it was safe. So there were a lot of people out of those areas already. The police teamed up with the Defence Force yesterday to get around and evacuate more people. The Defence Force actually sent in a helicopter to evacuate people out as fires raged around that town, but apparently not many, if any, people got on that helicopter before it had to leave because the winds picked up. A lot of people chose to stay and defend their town.
Right, so what's the priority for authorities today?
Well, it'll go back to what's been the hub of activity over the last couple of weeks, and that's getting out to communities that are still very, very isolated, getting them support, getting them supplies. That includes getting through roads that are still basically unusable. Even the Prince's Highway is still shut east of Orbost. The 150-kilometre stretch to Mallacoota is still littered with burnt trees, still burning trees across the Prince's Highway. If you can imagine that, the military sent a convoy through there and described how they had to drive around these trees yesterday and drive over the top of them. And that's just that one road. So if you think about all the roads in this area, it's going to be a huge task.
Right, and residents in these areas have had to get themselves up and prepared for spike days like yesterday several times this summer. You've been covering this for quite a while. It must be getting exhausting for them.
It is, Tom. I was in Bruthen yesterday speaking to some of the locals there, and they spoke of how difficult it is to keep getting up mentally and physically every time one of these high-risk fire days comes along. And it's also beginning to take a financial toll. I spoke with Annie Pierce, who's the manager of the Bruthen Neighbourhood Centre, and she described to me the fact that people are having to fork out money for things that they normally wouldn't, including accommodation if they've evacuated. So it's beginning to really take its toll financially.
We had some people that just went and booked accommodation. People weren't prepared to actually stay at the relief centre either, so they didn't have a van or a tent or whatever, so they've spent extra money on fuel. Like, I know that even myself and my husband have done two or three trips into Bairnsdale picking up supplies for here. You know, there's extra expenses, or you've forgotten something, you've forgotten toothpaste at home or something. So you tend to be spending a lot more money.
Annie Pierce, the manager of the Bruthen Neighbourhood Centre, and David Sparks reporting there from East Gippsland in Victoria. Thousands of protesters have rallied across Australia questioning the federal government's handling of the bushfire crisis and its climate policies. The marches shut down streets in Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth during peak hour, but the biggest event was in the middle of Sydney's CBD. Our reporter Eleanor Whitehead was there.
They came from the city and beyond, calling for action on climate change and the Prime Minister's resignation. Thousands crowded around Sydney's town hall, causing delays to traffic and light rail, before marching onwards through the CBD towards Parliament House. Some were new to protests. driven by anger at the bushfires and the government's climate policies. 31-year-old David came from Campbelltown.
Have become increasingly frustrated. The apocalyptic scenes that we've got at the moment are just the catalyst for me to get up and do something, you know?
The organisers, Uni Students for Climate Justice and Extinction Rebellion, want pay for firefighters and an immediate transition away from fossil fuels. 26-year-old Amy joined from Marrickville in Sydney's inner west.
We've been suffering with the smoke in this city for months, and we're lucky. I've got asthma. I'm struggling to breathe, and I'm lucky.
How would you like to see the government respond in the short term?
Humanely, with empathy. I think that's a huge thing. I think the way Scott Morrison's handled this and his lack of empathy to the whole situation is embarrassing. I'd like the firefighters to be funded more. I'd like more schemes to be set up, and just money, and to actually admit that climate change is real. Like, it's clearly happening. This is what we're doing about it. We're marching.
Thousands of others joined marches in Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth and Hobart. In Melbourne, in a rally which was smaller than Sydney's, protesters defied the rain to block streets in the CBD. They'd been criticised by police and politicians, who said resources were being diverted from frontline firefighting to manage the crowds. But first-time protester Marcus Johnson said he hoped the event might shift the debate.
I've just seen a lot of talking on the news about ScoMo going to Hawaii for the holiday while the fires are on, and I just want to see if this can change anything.
Melbourne protester Marcus Johnson and Eleanor Whitehead with that report. Well, protesters have turned out across Europe as well as the bushfire crisis continues to attract international attention. They stopped traffic in London and there were also rallies in Berlin, Madrid, Copenhagen and Stockholm. Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan spoke to some of the people who gathered outside Australia House in London.
A very long way from where the fires are raging, Londoners gathered on a crisp day to make their voices heard.
The scale of these fires are an ecological as well as a human disaster, would you agree?
Many wore koala hats to represent the massive loss of wildlife in Australia. Fee Radford from Bristol carried a sign which said, "Koalas, not coal." She and her friend Madeline Town came from Bath and Bristol.
Tell the truth.
This is about telling the truth of the impact of dangerous climate change now, which is what we're seeing, and it's the beginning, it's not the end. And we have to act now as a global community, as you say, but Australia must talk to the people about the consequences of coal. And people need to know that.
And Australia, you are custodians of precious species that exist nowhere else in the world.
Anne Coates from Sheffield became emotional when she spoke about watching what's happened to communities in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia.
The government should be listening. Your Prime Minister especially is, he's just the laughingstock around the world. In fact, he's not the laughingstock because we're absolutely furious with him. And I don't know what it's going to take. I feel that people will become so mentally ill with this disaster because it's just too much for your heart. You just can't live with it. It just gets worse and worse every day.
Among the protesters were some of the tens of thousands of Australians living in London. Harley McDonald-Eckersall is from Melbourne.
What's it been like for you being here in the UK and watching from afar what's been happening to our fellow Australians and also to the environment, the animals back home?
Look, it's devastating. It's been so horrible being so far away from my friends and family. Australians are extraordinarily resilient people. Like, our First Nations people have survived genocide and are still continuing to try and care for the environment. It's horrible to see the devastation that's being wrought in my country.
Australian Dylan Berthier says the catastrophic conditions at home should force global leaders to adopt tougher measures to prepare for disasters.
I think that we all have a responsibility to put pressure on the Scott Morrison government to do something about the fires. I think a crisis of this magnitude is a global crisis. I think world leaders have a responsibility to call on the Australian government to enact new policy that will actually prevent this from happening in the future.
In Berlin, Madrid and Stockholm, hundreds turned out at similar protests also organised by the climate action group Extinction Rebellion. The bushfire emergency has been front page news in Europe for weeks. When the British Parliament returned earlier this week, Speaker Lindsay Hoyle said what's happening in Australia should act as a wake-up call for the world. This is Bridget Brennan in London reporting for Saturday AM.
And we'll have more coverage of the bushfire crisis later in the program. The United States has revealed tough new economic sanctions on Iran in the wake of Tehran launching ballistic missiles at bases housing American troops. The attack was retaliation for the US assassination of top military general Qasem Soleimani, which the White House has justified by saying he was planning an imminent attack on American forces. But the press conference called to talk through the sanctions was dominated by questioning over how imminent the threat was, with senior secretary aides revealing they didn't know what day or what minute the attack was planned for. North America correspondent Catherine Diss has this report.
Secretary Pompeo, what is your definition of imminent?
This was going to happen, and American lives were at risk, and we would have been...
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wanted to talk about America's punishing new economic sanctions imposed on Iran, but he couldn't escape scrutiny swirling over the White House justification for killing top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
Mr. Secretary, the administration said this strike was done based on an imminent threat, but this morning you said we didn't know precisely when and we didn't know precisely where. That's not the definition of imminent.
We had specific information on an imminent threat, and those threat stream included attacks on U.S. embassies. Period. Full stop.
So you were mistaken when you said you didn't know precisely when and you didn't know precisely where.
Completely true. Those are completely consistent thoughts. I don't know exactly which minute. We don't know exactly which day it would have been executed.
The White House reasoning for the assassination: Qasem Soleimani posed an imminent threat to America. But President Donald Trump and his top defense brass have remained tight-lipped on the timing of the attack. Mr. Trump has since revealed he was plotting a strike on a U.S. embassy. His secretary, Mike Pompeo, went further.
Against American facilities, including American embassies, military bases, American facilities throughout the region.
The White House's loose definition of the word imminent has also enraged Congress. The Democrat-controlled House has voted to rein in the Commander-in-Chief's military powers.
The House will pass a War Powers Resolution to limit the President's military actions regarding Iran.
Three of his own party joined Team Blue to pass the measure. It will now go to the Republican-controlled Senate. And while the president has declared Iran's retaliation ineffective because it didn't claim any American lives, if the Ukrainian plane downed in Tehran in the hours after was in fact hit by an Iranian missile by mistake, his decision to escalate tensions will have had a consequence: the deaths of 176 people. The consequence the White House wants to focus on: its new economic sanctions and the impact it's having on Iran. Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin.
As a result of these actions, we will cut off billions of dollars of support to the Iranian regime, and we will continue our enforcement of other entities.
The sanctions are strangling the Iranian economy, but it hasn't yet stopped Tehran's aggression towards America. This is Catherine Diss in Washington, reporting for AM.
Well, meanwhile, Western nations are pressuring Iran to conduct an open investigation into the downing of a passenger jet near Tehran. And it comes as more evidence emerges that the plane was blasted out of the sky by an Iranian missile. Here's Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey.
The flight recorder hasn't been analysed, the wreckage barely gathered, but Iran's aviation chief says he can rule out one possible cause of the crash of Ukraine International Airlines Flight 752. What we can say with absolute certainty is that no missile has hit this plane. The plane has travelled while on fire for more than 1.5 minutes, and the crash site shows that the pilot had decided to return to the airport. But footage from near Tehran Airport and verified by the New York Times and independent journalism group Bellingcat shows what happened before the plane caught fire. A projectile streaks up and strikes the aircraft. 11 seconds later, the sound of an explosion. Even before the release of this video, intelligence agencies of the United States, Canada and the UK said they were all but certain that the Boeing 737-800 was targeted by at least one, possibly two, Russian-made Iranian air defence missiles. The interceptor's launch was captured by spy satellites. Ukraine says its investigators are being given access to the wreckage and they're already at work decoding the flight data recorders. A team from Boeing is assisting, and France and the United Kingdom have offered help. UK Foreign Minister Dominic Raab says the investigation must be transparent.
Our view on the crash underlines why we urgently now need an independent, full and transparent investigation to establish what caused it. The Iranian regime must open up to the international community, including access to the crash site, so we can get the truth as quickly as possible to give the families of the victims an understanding of what happened to their loved ones.
The Iranian civil aviation chief, Ali Abadzada, says Western nations must explain why they think a missile struck the plane. Boeing has definitely not confirmed the missile impact yet. This is what American politicians have said. Iran says its investigation into the disaster could take 2 years. This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for Saturday AM.
China will face a major test of its influence today as voters go to the polls in the self-ruled democratic state of Taiwan. The Chinese Communist Party has never ruled the island, but insists it must and it will, and has launched a four-year campaign to pressure the current government to accept its demands. Our China correspondent, Bill Birtles, is in Taipei.
Political rallies in Taiwan are a bit like rock concerts. Big screens, sing-alongs and enthusiastic crowds. It's the night before Election Day and President Tsai Ing-wen is taking the stage in front of hundreds of thousands of supporters. Local issues are very much in play, but she's used the recent unrest in Hong Kong to portray herself as the defender of Taiwan's democracy. The polls suggest it's been a fairly popular stance. After years of Beijing poaching Taiwan's allies, threatening its military and marginalising it on the world stage, the idea of forging better ties with Beijing doesn't seem particularly popular right now. A candidate for President Tsai's party, Fan Yun, says the unravelling of Hong Kong society under China's rule has spooked a lot of voters in Taiwan.
What happened in the street of Hong Kong actually was broadcast in Taiwan's TV. So almost every Taiwanese know what's happening in Hong Kong. So they start to question whether we can really make a deal with China and whether we should trust Beijing's promise.
If the polls are wrong and Tsai Ing-wen is swept from power, the new leader will be a 62-year-old city mayor who has pledged better ties with the superpower across the water. Han Kuo-yu's party, the KMT, are viewed in China as being much more amenable to Beijing's advances. But many KMT supporters say they care most about local issues.
We want a safe Taiwan, a prosperous Taiwan. Tsai Ing-wen has turned Taiwan into an isolated country. People are poor because our products don't have a market. All she does is lie. But Han Kuo-yu, he's a man of his word.
In the lead-up to the poll, China has tried to hurt the island's economy by preventing citizens from travelling to Taiwan as individual tourists. Taiwan's foreign minister has warned of much more covert meddling. Given his obsession with gaining control of Taiwan and determining its future, China's President Xi Jinping has a lot at stake. But it's the Taiwanese themselves who have the vote, something the communist leader across the water can't control. This is Bill Birtles in Taipei, reporting for AM.
Well, back to our coverage of the bushfires now, and the Defence Chief has praised military personnel for helping to provide comfort to thousands of Australians caught up in the crisis. General Angus Campbell says those taking part in the disaster response will be in it for the long haul, and he's warned the worst of the bushfire season could still lie ahead. Defence correspondent Andrew Green reports from on board HMAS Adelaide.
For the past week, Australia's largest warship has sat just off the coast of Eden in southern New South Wales. Unlike HMAS Jules in Victoria, this massive landing helicopter dock has so far not conducted any evacuations, but the crew of HMAS Adelaide is busy. Captain Leif Maxfield says they're now completing around 30 relief missions a day, reaching bushfire-stranded communities by watercraft or helicopter.
Reaching into these communities that are isolated and just
their responses to the support has been very positive, but just how resilient they are. And they just, very appreciative to know that as this situation can change, that all of the state services and the ADF are there, postured ready for their continued support.
As HMAS Adelaide enters its second week of bushfire operations, it's received a visit from Defence Minister Linda Reynolds and Defence Chief General Angus Campbell.
Absolutely outstanding. And there should be nothing prouder in your hearts than the fact that this mission is about helping Australians. And there's a lot of people out there who need that help.
Nearby at HMAS Albatross, the Defence Minister and General Campbell also met members of Army's 7th Brigade who've just arrived for Operation Bushfire Assist duties.
Australians are helping Australians. And that is an incredibly comforting experience for our people.
The soldiers listened intently to their boss, but came armed with questions.
There are millions of hectares of forest destroyed, communities isolated, and people need to have that sense that we're reaching out and we're going to be part of the story of rebuilding this country.
When does our contribution stop? Are we planting trees afterwards?
We're going to be in it for a long haul. I can't give you a time. We're still halfway through the bushfire season. And we don't know if it's going to get worse in time or get better.
Back on board HMAS Adelaide, attention is turning to properly mapping out suitable access points all along the New South Wales south coast for future relief missions, while also carefully monitoring where the next emergency may arise. This is Andrew Green on board HMAS Adelaide reporting for Saturday AM.
Well, while we've heard about the latest on the bushfires this morning, other parts of Australia are beginning to rebuild. And part of that involves clearing the debris, like ash and fallen trees. But scientists are warning people not to be overzealous, saying what looks like another dead tree could be important for the recovery of the ecosystem. Alexandra Beach has more.
As a bush regeneration volunteer in the New South Wales Blue Mountains, Lachlan Garland has seen the greenery return after many fires.
You start showing little bits of green coming up and the things that come back from seed that need a burn to actually come back from seed just start popping up again once the weather changes and we start getting a little bit of rain.
He says the process of recovery is different for every disaster and every landscape, but the trees do eventually come back.
Just leave it and see what happens.
Landscape ecologist David Lindenmeyer from the Australian National University agrees. He says while trees and debris near homes should be cleared for safety reasons, where possible, he's urging people to leave the burnt-out bush alone.
We've found that in other studies, including after the massive fires in 2009, that residual logs and standing trees, fire-killed trees, but also fire-damaged trees that then resprouted, we found that those parts of the environment were really critical habitats for a whole range of species. And the rate of recovery was much faster for birds, for mammals, native reptiles, and a whole range of plants when those elements of the forest and the woodlands were actually retained and not removed.
David Lindenmeyer's warned that well-meaning residents clearing out their local bushland could accidentally get in the way of that ecosystem's recovery. He says the ash on the ground can hold important nutrients for regeneration. Trees that look dead often surprise you by coming back, and even the dead trees serve a purpose.
There's a whole range of Australian species of bats, for example, that specialise in nesting in large dead trees.
University of New South Wales ecologist Mark Uwe says eucalypts are often the first to show signs of new life, but the drought could delay the recovery of other plants.
Even after a fire event like this, you'll have species with plenty of seeds that are ready to go, but if there's no rain or just small patches of rain, you might get some recruitment and then those seedlings will die if we continue on with the drought.
And he says in some areas, recovery may not be possible at all. The fires this summer have burnt through parts of Australia that wouldn't normally burn, wet areas and rainforests. Dr. Uwe says scientists just don't know how the vegetation there copes with bushfires.
The time taken for these sorts of areas to come back, for some of them it's actually unknown. It's highly likely that we're going to lose some species that really just aren't adapted to burning.
He says it could take years before the full impact on native plants becomes clear.
Alexander Beach with that report. And remember, ABC News will keep you up to date with the fires across the weekend. That's Saturday AM for today. I'm Thomas Arete. Thanks for your company. Have a happy and safe weekend. It's 8:30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.